WIOX is supported by the following community underwriters: Rockland Cider Works upstate in Gilboa, an agritourism cidery with vacation rentals on a sprawling former dairy farm. Gluten-free hard cider made from 100% New York State apples. New York State produced beer, wine, and spirits. Rockland Cider Works upstate on Stryker Road in Gilboa. RocklandCiderWorks.com. Catskill Mountain Cleaning, specializing in Airbnbs, vacation homes, and private residences. Cleaning, firewood stack, trash removal, and small pest exterminating. Serving the Catskills region, including Margaretville, Andes, Bovina, and the surrounding area. More information at 607-261-1674 or CatskillMountainCleaning.com. O'Connell and Aronowitz, attorneys at law since 1925. For legal representation from the routine to the more complex, committed to the fair treatment of all individuals. Family law, wills, trusts, and estate planning, litigation, accidents, and personal injury, constitutional law, Medicaid planning, elder care, and health law, criminal defense, not-for-profit and entity formation, commercial financing. O'Connell and Aronowitz, attorneys at law, 518-462-5601. 518-462-5601. OALaw.com. Sam's and Fleischmann's, Sam's Country Store Deli and Gas Station. Open every day for groceries, Mexican herbs, local craft beer, and with food to go, sandwiches, tortas, and tacos, and on weekends, tamales. Sam's on Main Street in Fleischmann's. SamsCountryStoreNY.com. Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center on State Route 10 in Walton for disposal and recycling. Open 7:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Tuesday through Saturday. Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center. Information about materials and disposal fees at 607-832-5800 or see the Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center link at WIOXradio.org.
Hi, I'm William Duke, host of Spiritual Solutions. Alternate Monday afternoons from 1 to 2, right here on WIOX Roxbury. Community radio, live and local in New York's Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and on MTC Cable Channel 20 and WIOXradio.org.
Okay, you are listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20 and at 107.5 FM on the campus of SUNY Delhi on smart devices through the Radio FM app and everywhere at WIOXradio.org where it's easy to donate. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John's out tonight, but we got Zane. Zane, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm all right. What have you been up to?
Well, earlier in the week, I was with a member couple down in Sullivan County. We're enjoying some beech nuts we found on the forest floor. They tried them for the first time. They're pretty good.
Not bad.
Yeah. You got a long fingernail. You can peel them away, and yeah, pretty tasty.
Beech nuts are kind of like miniature chestnuts, you know?
Yeah. They don't got much flavor, but some food in the forest.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I was in Florida, and it was like 85 degrees down there. Palm trees, and you can have that, because I don't like July here. So, but I can't complain. The beaches down there are beautiful, but it is hot, man.
Palm trees, right?
Palm trees. Not a true tree, right?
No. More like grass.
Yeah.
I guess.
They are weird. But we got a big show tonight, and tonight's topic is the potential of regulated commercial hunting as a management tool to regenerate New York forests. And our guest speaker is Dr. Paul Curtis. He has a PhD in zoology from North Carolina State. He is a professor in the Department of Natural Resources at Cornell University. He has coordinated the Wildlife Damage Management Program at Cornell for the past 30 years, which focuses on reducing conflicts, economic losses, and human health and safety concerns caused by wildlife in both rural and suburban landscapes. His work includes wildlife fertility control and population management, community-based wildlife management issues, and public education. Dr. Curtis is also testing novel methods for reducing wildlife damage to agricultural crops and forest regeneration. And let me see if I can get Dr. Curtis on. Are you there?
Hello. How are you doing, Ryan?
Good. How have you been?
I've been fine.
How's the weather up in, where are you, Ithaca?
I'm actually just north of Ithaca, and it's cool and rainy here like it probably is in a lot of central New York.
Yeah, that's correct. It's rain, just starting to rain down here. So before we get into the meat of the show, what got you into all of this?
Been interested in wildlife management and particularly deer ever since my undergrad days back in the 1970s. And after moving to New York in the early 1990s, it seems like deer-related issues were on the increase, so I started doing more research and outreach related to deer, and it's just been taking over a big part of my time for the last three decades.
Is that where you're from? Down south, or where are you from?
No, I'm actually from Ohio in the Midwest, but I bounced all around the country in school and finished my doctoral work at North Carolina State, so spent 7 years there before moving to New York.
Oh, cool. So how about just a brief background of the history of deer in New York State? I know that's a pretty big question, but what can you tell us about deer historically and presently?
Well, historically, pre-European settlement, probably deer densities are relatively low. Think of the entire Northeast is probably covered pretty much in mature forest. And if you look at deer densities in mature forest areas of the Adirondacks and the Catskill, those tend to average about 8 to 12 deer per square mile. So probably much of the Northeast had deer densities similar to that. We had the full complement of natural predators, including, you know, black bears, mountain lions, coyotes, wolves, and we also had Native Americans hunting deer at those times. So probably deer densities were quite a bit lower than they are today.
Hmm. Yeah, I think the latter are probably the biggest predator, but I don't know.
Dr. Curtis, how do you measure deer densities? How was it done historically, if at all, and how has those metrics kind of changed today? Like a brief explanation.
Yeah, it's really difficult to get accurate numbers of deer without having tagged animals on the landscape. And so having done several studies with ear-tagged deer and mark recapture computer simulation, we can get pretty reasonable and reliable estimates of abundance. And then we can correlate what we see from study herds with vegetation impacts and other indicators of deer abundance that are much easier to measure elsewhere in New York State and get a reasonable estimate of numbers in the woods. But it's really tough to get reliable numbers without spending a lot of time and money marking animals.
Is there a place where the deer herd is healthier than another in relation to the habitat in New York State?
I think statewide our deer herds are generally healthy overall. Probably I've seen deer of the lightest body weight out on Long Island. And I think a combination for that, the deer are a bit smaller out there. The nutrition's not as good given the sandy soils on Long Island. And deer in most upstate areas are in pretty good shape. I would say they're healthy overall.
Huh. Yeah, my experience in the Catskills is that would not be the case. I feel like their weights are reducing. Just hunting clubs show that pretty much data-wise, it almost seems at this point, from the 70s or even 50s to now. But our it's just so browsed out in the six counties of the Catskills, especially in the southern ones, that their weights just can't hold stable. I mean, I live in the original pilot of the antler restriction, and I don't know if it's done much good, to be honest with you, as far as producing bigger antlers.
Well, definitely the Catskills are a challenging spot because, again, you've got more mature forests. The winters tend to be longer. So all those things would lead towards lighter deer, and particularly if the woods are over-browsed. I've known places in the Catskills where it's really difficult to regenerate trees at all if it's not fenced down there.
Yep. Sure. So who owns the wildlife, I guess, is a question. I think a lot of people who aren't involved in the management of deer or whatever, you know, we don't think about who is responsible for managing deer in New York State.
Yeah, in terms of ownership, it's everyone and no one. We all own a piece of deer in New York State, but no one really privately owns deer. So the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation as deer and other wildlife are a public trust resource, and the DEC staff and biologists are charged to manage deer for the public good and for sustainability for current years and into the future to benefit all the people of New York State.
You have a question, Zane?
I guess we could talk about some of the impacts of deer at the kind of local scale, somebody's backyard, up until landscape scale.
Okay, so there's three primary impacts or drivers that I think most people are interested in. One is damage to plants, be it forest regeneration if you've got a woodlot, or landscape ornamentals or your garden plants if you're a home gardener. The second impact people are interested in is tick-borne diseases, such as Lyme disease, but there's a host of other diseases that black-legged and lone star ticks carry that could be passed on to people. And a third impact people tend to be concerned about are deer vehicle collisions. And in a state like New York, larger states like New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, we probably kill somewhere in the neighborhood of 70,000, 80,000 plus deer a year on our highways and deer vehicle accidents.
How do they impact the forest?
They impact the forest by reducing biodiversity, particularly with trees and wildflowers and other herbs. Deer are selective browsers, and so there are species like oaks and maple and some of the more valuable hardwood species that we really want to perpetuate in our forest are some of their favorite browsing species. And things like striped maple or American beech tend to be fairly deer-resistant. Not that deer won't eat them, but they're much lower on the list, and they'll eat other things first. So over time, with deer being selective browsers, they tend to remove those species that they most like to eat first, and that changes the composition of the forest. You got to remember that the forest, the mature forest we see today, were probably regenerated 80 to 100 years or more ago when deer densities were much lower than they are today.
I mean, we are assuming, though, that deer numbers were lower in the past. We don't really know that. I mean, how do we know that human beings weren't burning more? How do we know there wasn't more deer in the 1500s? We don't know these things.
I'm not talking about that far back. I'm talking about in late 1800s, early 1900s. You know, the forest of today allow those forests to were developed in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the older growth, more mature forests. And at that point in time, deer densities were probably their lowest in history. Deer were extirpated from some counties in New York State. In fact, in a lot of central New York, it was extremely rare to see a deer in the early 1900s.
Sure.
But since then, obviously, they've rebounded, and they're doing quite well, partly because of changes in habitat with farm abandonments in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, reforestation of areas, and also targeted management by DEC in New York and other state wildlife agencies, trap and transfer programs to repopulate areas where deer had been extirpated, and that intensive management was very successful. And by the 50s and 60s, we had deer back where they historically were, and populations were rebounding in many areas.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like the deer herd also came back on its own from forest regeneration. I mean, according to Severinghouse, the Conservation Commission, the deer herd peaked in 1898 in the Adirondacks following all that cutting. And we see our deer numbers in the Catskill Mountains, the higher elevations, they were probably higher in the 50s and 70s. And I looked at the data of DEC, and it indicates that despite hunting pressure and everything else. So what I'm getting at is we have extremely low deer numbers here. We've done some studies in the Catskill Mountains. It's anywhere from 4 to maybe 9 or 10 deer a square mile. And we have a browse issue. So do you think it's more important, is the relationship between the habitat and deer numbers, or is it merely deer numbers? I mean, what do you think?
It's a combination. It's habitat and deer number. You're only going to have as many deer on the landscape as the habitat can support. And when areas have been chronically over-browsed for many years, the habitat is less and less capable of sustaining high deer numbers unless you have major changes in the habitat, such as a big blowdown or something like that, where you get acres and acres of early successional habitat that puts a lot of sprouts in the reach of deer, and they'll respond quickly to that. You know, Severinghouse's report did. Heavy cutting in the Adirondacks created thousands of acres early successional habitat that the deer responded to.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even where I grew up in New Paltz, it's starting to actually, the forest is starting to mature a little bit, and the deer numbers are plummeting, but the browse doesn't necessarily go down, unfortunately.
Yeah, each adult deer needs to eat about 6 to 8 pounds of forage a day, and then so when that's in the form of little twig tips and seedling tips, that's a lot of seedling, probably about 500-600 seedling tips per pound of forage, and so a single deer can have significant impact on quite a bit of habitat.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is the potential of regulated commercial hunting as a management tool to help regenerate New York forests. And we're talking to Dr. Paul Curtis from Cornell University. All right, so before we get to commercial harvesting, I guess if you do need to reduce numbers of deer to alleviate pressure on forest resources or regeneration, what are the options a manager, mainly the DEC, have?
Well, really, the only option available at a landscape scale is regulated sport hunting, and that's been effective in many states throughout the eastern U.S. for decades. And there's quite a bit of science and research that's gone into that. Generally, by issuing certain levels of antlerless tags, DEC can send the trajectory of the population up or down depending on deer impact to the forest. And that's one of the indicators of importance of the new 5-year deer management plan that DEC's rolled out recently, is looking at habitat indicators to try to bring deer numbers in balance with the habitat and make sure we sustain our forest. So again, hunting is really the only tool that works at a landscape scale.
What kind of metrics, I mean, going back to deer densities, how do you kind of measure overabundance by looking at habitat? How do you look at just area and the quality of the habitat on the ground and just determine from there how many deer can it support? What would be too much?
Yeah, again, looking at past history of the forest, if it's in early successional stages versus more mature forest, you can get a rough feel for deer abundance. But then you can use other indicators, actually measuring and counting seedlings on the ground, we developed a protocol called AVID, Assessing Vegetation Impacts from Deer, in collaboration with DEC staff. And we've been using that with volunteer woodland owners throughout the state to try to get some on-the-ground real-time measures of deer impact. The forest, the USDA Forest Inventory announced the FIA data set does a fairly good job of that, but the problem is they only survey a certain number of plots, a certain percentage of plots for regeneration, and they only census plots every 5 years. So in terms of long-term trends, the FIA data set's pretty good. But in terms of year-to-year data that you need in real time to set deer management objectives and issue antlerless tags, the FIA data set really doesn't work all that well for those objectives. So that's why we're hoping AVID and getting enough volunteers on board will help provide more real-time data.
Yeah, and, you know, well, we've talked about this on previous shows. We talked a little bit about trust, how the deer are owned in trust by, you know, we all own the deer. The problem, I think, is that the deer don't live on public land, right? I mean, you're talking about FIA data and monitoring the browse impacts, but that's private land, right, mostly?
Yeah, that's the private land primarily. Most of the plots are on private land, and most of the deer occur on private land in New York and other eastern states, so that's no big surprise. Very different from the West, where you have lots of wildlife on public land. Here in the East, we've got a relatively small percentage of public lands. We've got, you know, the Catskill Forest Preserve and the Adirondack Forest Preserve, state-protected areas. But still, even within those, there's a lot of private lands that are mixed-use areas. So we've really got to work with private landowners if we're going to be successful at managing deer at the landscape scale.
So it's just, okay, so the DC has to use sport hunting. Because that's their biggest tool in the metaphorical toolbox to manage deer numbers. Is it working?
It's working generally overall. Is it working everywhere? No. There are definitely places that have problems. And part of the issues are biological. Again, trying to come up with good metrics of deer abundance and impacts to adjust antlerless quota. And part of it's political. Sometimes when DEC would like to take maybe a more aggressive stance and reduce deer numbers to increase forest regeneration, they can get pushback from hunters and other stakeholder groups. So there's a stakeholder dimension, too. So we can't just rely on the science and the biology. There's the human element we've got to consider.
Yeah. So what is the demographic of hunters? I mean, is this more of an opportunity going forward? What's the average age of hunters? How much time does a sport hunter spend per deer harvested?
Yeah, it's when I look at the real data, it's kind of scary, the amount of time per deer harvested. From our own hunting program on Cornell lands and around campus, it's about somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 to 80 hours on average per deer harvested. And that's not atypical for most gun hunting programs. A lot depends on access. A lot depends on the type of season. It would be more for bow hunters in some cases than it would be for gun hunters. Depends, again, like I said, on access to deer and deer densities. But on average, you're looking at probably 70, 80-plus hours per deer harvested.
I know the average age used to be around 51, I think, according to what I believe I read from what you wrote. Oh, do you know what it is now, or has it changed? Or
I haven't seen recent data, but the last I saw was in the mid-50s, and it's probably not getting any lower. It seems the hunter population is aging. We're not recruiting as many youth into hunting as we once did. So I think we're going to see numbers of hunters continue to decline slowly over time, and hunting participation will drop in the future. And that's going to mean fewer hunters on the landscape. And as land gets more and more parcelized, private land, access is probably going to become more restricted in the future.
So if hunters are the number one tool, what's plan B? What's the second most commonly used tool to manage deer numbers?
Well, right now we don't really have a plan B. There's specialized management in suburban areas where deer are overabundant. where communities can work with DEC under research or management permits to hire sharpshooters and implement culling programs to get deer numbers down and down to goal densities for their local area. But for in terms of a broad landscape scale, there is no plan B. The only practical tool we have right now is hunting, so we've got to figure out how to make that work as best as possible.
All right, so this is kind of segue into what tonight's main event is about, is the potential of regulated commercial hunting. So when recreational hunting fails or is not delivering as good as it can be, may have to turn to commercial hunting, which is kind of like sacrilegious in wildlife management in North America, no?
Yeah, there's been a lot of negatives associated with commercial hunting just because the era of overexploitation in the late 1800s when not only deer but other wildlife suffered tremendously due to habitat changes and local overharvest in some areas. And so I think the public has a perception, some of the public, that hunting is bad, and particularly commercial hunting where you're selling meat is a negative, and we shouldn't be doing those type of things. So it makes it a really tough sell for the general public.
Yeah, I mean, I find that most people don't realize you can't sell wild meat. I don't think the public, most people who don't hunt, are aware of that.
Probably not, because you could go to your local supermarket and buy exotic game meats that have been brought in from other countries. But you're right, you know, you can't legally sell wildlife that's harvested here in North America, for example, deer, rabbits, small game, pheasants, whatever. You can donate, you can give it away, but you can't legally sell it.
I guess, you know, I got to ask you this, and you probably disagree maybe, but I don't really know. But when you bring up market hunting, and I remember Jeremy Hurst, his answer immediately, he's the big game biologist, I think, for the DEC, right?
Yes.
He'll say, well, we can't go back to market hunting. That was the bad days. I just don't buy that. I used to, after researching it more, reading studies, there's a lot of studies out there on this topic, but market hunting to me is only bad when you don't have property rights. And the bison is kind of like the poster animal of that. That's what we talked about 2 weeks ago. I mean, there was just no property rights surrounding buffalo. So, yeah, it was just a race to kind of kill the animal as fast as you could, kind of like the oceans and ocean fishing. I mean, do you think market hunting is more severe than habitat changes? I mean, the Midwest was completely converted to cows. I think we're throwing markets under the bus is what I'm saying here.
Well, both were definitely detrimental to wildlife. And I think the habitat changes that we created for forestry and agriculture are probably a lot of people missed that point. And I think habitat was at least equally important as market hunting to the demise of many species in New York and other states. So habitat is a big factor. And we don't want to see the market hunting of the late 1800s. Nobody wants unregulated, rampant consumption and over-exportation of wildlife. What we're talking about with regulated commercial hunting is a highly regulated and restricted activity, only used in certain spots under oversight and guidance with probably special licensing and provisions.
So it's very different
from the 1800s.
But you can't regulate it too much because then it won't happen, right?
Yeah, you can regulate it quite a bit. Look at all the regulations we've got on the books for regular sport hunting. There's no reason it can't be regulated.
And look at the numbers.
Well, we regulate sale of pelts for fur bearers, so it can be done. When there's a precedent, some wildlife is sold, but under very regulated conditions. And I think we could get the laws and public support for it, that potentially it could happen with deer in areas where they're locally overabundant.
I don't know. I disagree. I think buffalo, there was just no property rights surrounding that animal, and to blame it on market hunting, I think, is just, you just can't have markets without property rights. And there was no one owned those buffalo. No one was responsible, and the tribes were dead. The ranchers were more concerned about the property rights surrounding cows. And there's markets on cows. Cows weren't going away. They were protected by property rights.
Yeah, well, it's not just property. There's a whole social justice issue we can get into, because the The bison were sort of really important part of the culture and the lives of the Plains Indians. And so because of government choices to remove Native American from big swaths of land by removing the bison, it impacted their culture and their livelihood. So there's social justice issues, too.
Yeah.
We've got to throw into the mix.
Yeah. No, but what I'm saying is that, you know, it was contended that once you remove the gatekeepers, the Native Americans, I don't even want to get into, you know, why, how that happened, all that. The bison were vulnerable, is my point.
Yeah, definitely. They were vulnerable.
But, go ahead, Zane.
Well, yeah, what are some, ways to start implementing a regulated commercial hunting program? What are the kind of these initial things you would do to start to transition to something like that?
Well, first, you've got to have public support because there's laws and regulations that would need to be changed both at the state level and then within D.C. regulation changes would need to follow those laws that would allow for sale of wildlife. And there are probably federal legislation, for example, if you wanted to sell any commercially harvested meat out of state, that would fall under Lacey Act federal provisions, too. So there's laws at several different levels of government that would need to be changed. There have been efforts, I think it was last one I saw was in New Jersey, to try to introduce legislation to start a pilot program, but it didn't go ahead. And I haven't seen legislation successful anywhere to date yet that would allow a pilot program to go forward.
So you just need to build up that public pressure. What are some good arguments that do you think the public would be receptive of for developing a program?
Well, there's a number of economic arguments. First, you know, where deer are locally overabundant, you've got human health and safety issues with Lyme disease and deer vehicle accidents, reducing deer abundance through regulated commercial harvest could help with some of those impacts. It'd be less expensive than some of the culling programs or the fertility control research that's happened in the past. It would open up potential new markets for a high-quality local protein, and with the locavore movement and other green foods that are popular with many people across the country, it could increase local economies that way. And overall, it could reduce other deer-human conflicts. For example, an overabundant suburban deer herds damage to garden plants and landscape ornamentals are often a big concern for many people, or damage to crops for farmers in New York and other states. So those folks would probably welcome lower deer abundance, and we could put that protein to good use.
I think that the locavore argument is one of the better ones because, it's aimed towards where people think about things the most, you know, their stomachs, their food, the exotic things to eat. I think there's a kind of changing culture where people are willing to try new things with food, and that might be a point where you can change a lot of minds, I think.
Right, and that would bring up a whole issue of how are the deer harvested, where are they harvested, how is the meat handled, what USDA regulations and protocol would need to be followed, how would the meat be inspected, would you allow firearms to take deer? Again, I'm more concerned about lead fragments in meat. With recent studies showing that's an issue, would you only allow deer to be taken with archery or non-lead bullets so that you don't have to worry about lead fragmentation in the meat? Would the meat need to be tested to make sure that there are no pesticide issues of deer and agricultural crops or urban areas where there's spraying for other arthropod pests? And so, again, there's a whole host of things that would have to be put in place, not that it can't be done, but it would take a fair amount of effort to do it.
There's just so many agencies. I mean, we had David Drake talk about this at the Growing Deer Debate from the University of Wisconsin. And he said the USDA would be a huge stumbling block because you have to have the inspection on a field-harvested animal. But just to put it in context for people, the risk. Do you know how many millions of meals are eaten every year of deer?
I wouldn't have a guess what that would be. It's got to be several million across the entire United States and Canada.
I mean, just in New York alone, I think it's, I think the Venison Donation Coalition, we had him on. It was like 25 million meals or something, something ridiculous. You know how many people get sick? I mean, if it's in the single digits, I mean, I don't even know of any. I don't know. And how many people parade their buck around town when they get it? You still don't hear of anyone getting sick. I mean, I just, these regulations got to be reduced. I just don't see it happening until we start, you know, freeing up things a little bit.
Yeah, it's going to take a concerted public effort, and it's going to have to be more than hunters or more than foresters. It's going to have to be a fair amount of the general public are going to have to feeling enough negative impacts that they go to the legislators and make the changes that are needed. And I agree with you. I don't see that happening anytime soon.
Yeah. If you're just listening in, this is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. We're talking to Dr. Paul Curtis from Cornell University about the potential of regulated commercial hunting as a management tool to regenerate New York forests. We're going to take a break, but we definitely got more questions for Dr. Curtis.
All I can do is write them in a song.
you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic, Ryan and Zane. Tonight's topic is the potential of regulated commercial hunting as a management tool to help regenerate New York forest. We're talking to Dr. Paul Curtis from Cornell University. So, arguments for developing a program for regulated commercial harvesting. This is when recreational hunting, sport hunting, is missing it or failing to deliver. What are some of the arguments against?
Well, probably the biggest argument against is public perception around exploitation and unregulated hunting, as we talked about in the late 1800s and the decimation of bison. Generally, when you ask people about hunting in human dimension surveys, trophy hunting and mark hunting come out at the bottom of the list. The majority of people support recreational hunting, but when you talk again about trophies or market, the public generally just doesn't support it. So that's going to be a huge hurdle. The second big hurdle is the one of public trust versus privatization of the wildlife resource. Right now, as we talked about, deer and other wildlife are a public trust resource in New York State, managed in perpetuity for current and future generations by DEC under statutory authority. If you take wildlife and start to privatize it and sell it commercially, then it's no longer a public trust resource. So there's going to be a lot of potential opposition to that. Yeah, again, people worried, one, about someone privatizing their deer that they own a piece of it as a citizen in New York State, but also concerns about exploitation. And then there's always questions related to commercial sale. Would a black market develop? Would somebody try to over-exploit and take advantage of the fact that you can now sell venison and potentially other wildlife? So that could be a potential hurdle. And then you've already mentioned previously the USDA guidelines and restrictions for processing meat in the field and examining the meat, make sure that it's safe for commercial sale. You know, those type of regulations would have to be put in place and potentially modified. So there are a number of hurdles that I think that are just make this very, very difficult currently to even put a pilot program in place.
Well, let's talk about some of them. Do you really think it's possible to over-harvest animals in most of New York State when there's such diversity of ownership and the small parcel sizes we have? I mean, this is not the 19th century where it was so homogenous back then. Most people were farmers, right? I mean, how could you over-harvest them today in, say, Westchester County or Ulster County or Sullivan? I can't see it happening.
Yeah, it's under current regulations, it's not possible. But again, with the way the property is split up now in the parcelization and each landowner having different interest in the wildlife on their lands, it would be very difficult. But that doesn't mean a group of landowners couldn't get together or a few large landowners couldn't get together. And you couldn't locally over-exploit deer or other wildlife. So I think it's possible, but it'd be definitely more difficult than it was in the 1800s.
Yeah, definitely. Unlikely. And like I said, there's such a diversity of land ownership. I don't know. I think even in the total absence of regulations, I think you'd be hard-pressed to greatly reduce the deer herd in the Hudson Valley. I think it would be extremely difficult.
You know, that would, again, trying to do that under a controlled experimental condition so we could learn from it.
Right.
What happens when we really loosen restrictions in a small area so we could learn from the experiment, that might be valuable.
Yeah.
But whether or not you could do it on a broad scale or not, a good question.
Before we get to the, you know, how hunters and non-hunters feel, what about your cohorts? I mean, I remember David Drake was under fire from the Wildlife Society when he even brought up this idea of commercial deer harvesting. What do you think about that?
Yeah, the wildlife biologists, they're really split on this topic, and they're really strong proponents. David Hunter's for initially, and equally strong opposition on the other side that are dead set against it for the reasons of over-exploitation and privatization of a public resource. It just And so I can't see the profession coming to a single mind on this. So, again, that makes it very difficult trying to move something like this forward.
Huh.
But they agree that there is an overabundance of deer. There's a habitat quality issue.
I think most biologists recognize that at least they're locally overabundance. Now, again, how broad that occurs, probably that occurs, you'll get differences of opinion, but at least most can agree in some places deer are locally overabundant. They're definitely impacting the habitat. We see it particularly in Hudson Valley and Long Island. I think that's where it's most severe in New York State.
Yeah. I guess in Sweden they do this, though. They don't have a problem with their moose population and the local deer there. I mean, you can sell the meat right in grocery stores in Sweden.
Yeah, again, other cultures are very different historically, and the European model is very different from the North American model of wildlife conservation. So a lot of it's going to be cultural changes, and those are probably the most difficult, trying to convince hunters and other conservationists that, you know, this is a viable alternative and it's worth a try.
Yeah. I mean, go ahead, Jane.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned in your article, what are some of the reasons why hunters currently wouldn't want regulated commercial hunting to happen? Just for more restricted access on their part? It would make it more competitive to hunt in the woods?
I think even if this regulated commercial harvest happened, it would first of all be in probably more urban suburban areas. It wouldn't be broadly in New York woodlands. It would be very small areas where deer were locally overabundant would be the first place permits were authorized. But I think that would create the perception of hunters that somebody's out there competing for their deer. And then, again, as a public trust resource, we all own those deer, so we all have a say in how they're managed. And so I think hunters would sense that if there was commercial regulated harvest, somebody be competing for our deer that they potentially should have access to.
Is there examples where we already have? I mean, it's really a spectrum. It's not like one or the other. It's not privatization or public trust. It's really a spectrum. On the spectrum, aren't other wildlife resources privatized in some ways?
Yeah, the
beaver.
Very few.
I mean, all fur bears, you can sell them.
The fur bears are the best example where you've got commercial sale of pelts. But other wildlife, really, there are very, very few examples. I'm hard-pressed to think of one other than the fur bears.
Gallbladders of bears. They can be sold.
Yeah, well, that's illegal to sell them.
It wasn't recently. You could sell them in Chinatown legally. The DEC, it was in this. I mean, I believe it was in the syllabus.
That would be news to me. I thought bear and gallbladder sales were illegal.
No, as far as I know, I'll look it up, and we'll correct it on next week's show. But I'm fairly certain you could sell gallbladders from a bear. It was shocking to me.
Yeah, well, it would be shocking to me, but that would be an exception to the rule again if it is true.
You can sell antlers. You can sell You can sell just about everything but the flesh.
And again, the current laws and regulations prevent that.
Yeah, but it's just so weird. You can sell a deer hide, can't sell backstrap, but you can buy a backstrap from New Zealand.
Yep, it's imported, obviously.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I think Texas, they're 97% privately owned. They're one of the few Western states they don't have much public land. We had Ruben Cantu on from Texas Parks and Wildlife, and they work mostly with private landowners because they figure the habitat is the most important part of this equation. Do you think it's important? And if it is, why isn't New York State DEC incentivizing their biggest asset, which is the habitat, privately owned habitat?
Well, first, the Texas model is different from just about every wildlife in the country, the way wildlife is managed in Texas. And you're right, it's much more privatized there.
Yeah.
But you look at the scale of things in Texas, landowners there, some of them control thousands and thousands of acres. And so you're right, the Texas Parks and Wildlife folks do work with large ranchers and large landholders to improve habitat, and it works for them under their system. In New York State, parcels tend to be much, much smaller. We're much more parcelized, and so it's a much more difficult task than it is in Texas.
Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, we used to have thousands-acre parcels. IP was all thousands of acres until we started treating the land as a liability, taxing it too much. I mean, that's when they started selling to TIMOs, right? Timber insurance programs from the West. That's when we started treating it as a liability and liquidating those liabilities. I mean, many of these parcels are much bigger than they used to be, but we treat forest as liabilities here in New York, it seems.
Yeah, but if you look at the average private landowner, not at the big commercial paper companies, commercial timber lands, but if you look at the average private landowner in New York State, the average woodland landowner probably owns less than 100 acres, so it's a very different scale again in Texas.
No doubt, but I think we didn't just arrive at that overnight. It happened. The average parcel size in the Catskills is 18 acres. I mean, and that's who we serve, Catskill Forest Association mainly. But it didn't happen overnight. It was 150 not too long ago. But, I mean, you know, apples to apples, no. It's not the same as Texas, but Texas, the ranchers seem to have an incentive to manage their habitat because they sell leases. And you know, it is a desert compared to here. I mean, we can grow timber and deer much bigger than Texas.
Well, if you look at other parts of the eastern United States, you can look at the southeastern United States and North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, a lot of the hunting land down there is leased also, and landowners are able to sell leased rights for hunting privileges on their property, and they invest those dollars back in the habitat. So yeah, it does work, but here in the Northeast, we're in a different cultural situation. We don't have anywhere near the number of leased acres here in the Northeast as they do in the southeastern or southern states.
Interesting. Zane, you have a question?
I think it's just we're just talking about incentives and just trying to align incentives better with good management at the end of the day, whether that's through public pressure, culture, or legislature, just trying to align all these incentives.
I think we're still in a challenge of just general education of the average woodland owner. Yeah. Yes, a lot of woodland owners can walk out and recognize deer browsing and see that deer impacting regeneration in our forest, but there are a number that can't. And so we've still got to work on public education so folks are aware of the issue and willing to do something about it.
Yeah, every landowner I've met is very motivated by having a very healthy forest, but health is just a very fuzzy concept sometimes. Objective measures, things like species diversity and structural diversity, those are things we can actually look at and measure and say, yes, this forest is regenerating. There's a future here. But people don't make that deer natural resource connection the way they do those impacts.
Yeah, and there are some confounding factors, too. I know in the Western Adirondacks and some parts of Pennsylvania, acid rain was an issue. And obviously, trees are going to grow more poorly on highly acid soils, and you're not going to get the growth potential you would on better soil. And so I've known people that wanted to blame the acid rain and say, oh, it's not the deer issue, it's acid rain that's really impacting our forest regeneration. And locally, that might be the case, but everywhere that I put up a deer fence in New York State after 3 or 4 years, usually there's if there's an adequate light getting in the forest floor where you expect regeneration inside and outside the fence after 3-4 years, there's a dramatic difference that's visible to your eyes.
Yeah, the fence is really, really gets to people. It really shows them well, I think.
And, we can't afford to fence everything that we want to regenerate, so we've got to come up with better ways to do it.
They can in Texas. Thousands of acres they're fencing. That's a big controversial thing in Texas, the high fences, they call them, wherever the hell they are. But they have an incentive to do it. When the cows don't pay the bills, the deer do. I guess, I know we need to educate landowners. That's what we do with the Catskill Forest Association. But landowners need to be protected, too, the rights. And what I mean by that is, you know how many members I have talked to who want to do environmental education centers on their land, who want to have little nature centers? You know, they're competing with another landowner called the City of New York and the State of New York, and they don't have equal liability costs. And that's a problem. If you're a private landowner and you're for-profit, commercial, you don't have equal liability. That's got to change.
Yeah, the liability law protects recreationists as long as you don't charge a fee for service. We ran into that with our own public hunting program on Cornell lands. We were thinking about charging folks access to our land for a small fee, but that would be a violation of the general obligation laws, and then we would have to take liability insurance out. So we chose not to do that. So hunting on our own Cornell lands continues to be free, so we meet the general obligations law guidelines.
Right. Well, that's got to change. I mean, it's just people have to be compensated for what they do, and if you're going to do true conservation, it takes money and time and labor and work. You should be compensated for it. That's too much to ask.
That's true, but that's probably more than either you and I can tackle on this show.
We might as well bring it up, though, right? What the hell?
Yeah. Get it out there.
Well, thanks for coming on, Dr. Curtis.
Yeah, it's been good to talk with you. I hope this was informative and helpful for your audience.
It definitely was, and we got to start somewhere. I mean, I know we're not going to solve all these, but someone's got to talk about it, and we appreciate your time.
Okay, glad to do it.
All right, we'll have you on again if you're willing, and you have a good night.
Okay, take care.
Take care. That was Dr. Paul Curtis and from Cornell University talking about regulated commercial harvesting as an option to help regenerate New York forest, and always good to have him on, and see you next week.
Good night, everyone.
All right, take care. Oh, the neon lights were flashing and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of the long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest. With a mighty roar, big jet soars above the canyon streets, and the con men con, but life goes on, for the city never sleeps. And to an old forgotten soldier, the dog